Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Olubumi Bakari. This is our All Things Local series, where we highlight the local history, culture, communities, and personages who have made an impact on Washington, D.C. and the world. Returning with me today is my guest, A. Peter Bailey. We're going to continue our conversation that we had over a month ago. Mr. Bailey is a journalist, author, lecturer, playwright. His work has appeared in Ebony and Essence magazines, the New York Times, New York Daily News, and the Negro Digest, just to name a few. He was the associate editor for Ebony magazine and served as the associate director of the Black Theater Alliance. He was also a close associate of Malcolm X and was founding member of Malcolm X's Organization of African American Unity. His works include Witnessing Brother Malcolm X, The Master Teacher, Harlem, Precious Memories, Great Expectations. He's the co-author of Revelations, the Autobiography of Alvin Ailey, with Alvin Ailey, and Seventh Child, a family memoir of Malcolm X with Rodnell P. Collins. He has also written a play entitled Malcolm Martin Megger. He currently writes a bi-monthly column for the Trice Edney Wire Service. Thank you for joining me again, Mr. Bailey.
Thank you.
Okay, so I wanted to kind of pick up where we left off in our last conversation. We were talking about the aftermath of the assassination of Malcolm X. So OAAU was just getting off the ground at the time of his assassination. So how did the members of the organization kind of carry on his work and his legacy after his assassination?
Unfortunately, it didn't really do very much. His sister, Ella Collins, tried to keep it going, but was not able to do so because so many people in the organization were just so grief-stricken over the assassination that we just kind of went into kind of almost like a recluse for a while. You know, we were just not interested in doing anything. And in fact, I was so struck that in July 1st, I left the country for 2 months. Mm-hmm. I just had to get away. And so the OAAU never really functioned very much. See, the OAAU was an organization that was in a state of becoming. Mm-hmm. We were having rallies and everything when Brother Malcolm was there and when he was away. And on that Sunday that he was assassinated, he said to us, the four or five of us who were backstage with him, he said to us that he was going to go speak down in Mississippi at the invitation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And that when he came back, he was going to spend the next 6 months building up the OAAU. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when he was in town, we might get 500 or 600 people at one of our meetings. When he wasn't there, we might get about 150. Mm-hmm. So he realized that he, you know, some work needed to be done. So, of course, he was assassinated before he could do that. Mm-hmm. And so the organization was not in a really good position to survive his assassination.
Mm. Now, one of the founding members was noted historian John Henry Clark. What was your relationship like with him? And did you maintain that relationship after being a part of this organization?
Oh, yes. I met Dr. Clark during the OAAU days. And I maintained contact with him up until he died. Mm-hmm. He was one of the people that I listened to. I always say that I was very fortunate to be able to sit at the feet and learn from Dr. John Henry Clark and Harold Cruz, the great author, mm-hmm. and a brother named Mahmoud Boutiba, who taught me propaganda analysis. Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of people, just taught us. And there were about five or six of us young guys, and they taught us. Mm-hmm. And so I maintained a relationship with Dr. Clark up until he died. I went to his house several times. He lived not too far from me in Harlem. And his basement, every inch, he had a brownstone in Harlem. Mm-hmm. Every inch of space was covered by bookshelves in his basement. He had books from everywhere. Mm-hmm. I had never seen anything like that in my life when I went to his home.
And so when I was looking at your memoir, I noticed that you found out pretty much later on that the FBI had kept a file on you and other members of the OAAU. So what was your reaction to learning about that?
Well, I was not surprised. Brother Malcolm had told us at the very beginning that if you were worried about going to the FBI files, then you should not get involved with him. He told us that. And I saw years later, must have been 20 years after the assassination, a friend of mine finally got a set of the files and sent me a copy of them on the OAAU. And the very first page said, the following members of the OAAU are unknown to us. And it listed seven names. My name was first name on the list because of the, alphabetical order. Mm-hmm. And after the following members of OAAU are unknown to us, then it listed us. Then after that, it said, the New York office is already in the process of checking them out. Mm. But you knew that.
Did you notice anyone like following you or?
No, they didn't do that kind of thing. Oh. I never noticed anything like that. I'm not going to say they didn't do it. I never noticed anything like that. But I do know that I was the editor of the newsletter. Mm-hmm. And in the FBI files, they included every editorial. I used to write the editorials for our newsletter. And they included the editorials in their files. They would run them and then comment on them. And so they, they were keeping very close watch on what we were doing.
And with the political climate the way that it is today, what do you think that Malcolm would make of it?
I think he always believed in an independent black-led political party. He did not believe in belonging to either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, because neither one of them have us as tops on their agenda. In fact, we may be down number 10 at best. So he was always very, very interested in forming an independent black-led political party. And so I think by now, if he was still around, with his organizing abilities and his charismatic ability to teach people and explain to them why things were important, we would have an independent black political party in this country today if he was still alive.
Mm. And I'm not going to ask that question. This is the D.C. Public Library radio show. So let's switch gears a bit and talk about your career as a journalist. So how did you move into the journalism field?
To be very frank, I had absolutely, until I got involved with Brother Malcolm, I had not even thought for a second about being a journalist. But when the OAAU was set up and people were volunteering to do various things, nobody volunteered to do the newsletter. So I said I would do it. And that's how I got into journalism. The first article I ever wrote for the first issue newsletter was around the killing of that young boy in Harlem in 1964 that led to the Harlem Uprising. My first article that I ever wrote was that story, because when this policeman shot this boy, mm-hmm. in the middle of the afternoon, someone called me at my job where I was working, and I rushed over there, and I got to interview some of the students. And I wrote this article based on that. And then I went from there I took some courses.
You were working at, I think it was Time, Inc.?
Time, Inc., uh-huh.
So what were you doing?
I was what they call a editorial reference clerk. Mm-hmm. Time, Inc. had two huge sets of files, the bio files and the company files. Mm-hmm. I worked in the bio files. And what I had to do was to read the New York City 7 daily newspapers. Mm-hmm. And anytime anybody's name was in those papers, to clip the article out and put it, you know, and file it. Mm-hmm. And then we took calls from reporters for files on people. And of course, so that was, you know, I did that from 1961 to 1965. And I realized now that was a great job for somebody my age, mm-hmm. because I got to really see, you know, the importance of information and how people organized and, you know, Time Inc. had everything well organized. And I was able to swipe stuff out of those files and give to Brother Malcolm.
Oh, really? Like what?
In information that might be there on someone he wanted to know something about, mm-hmm. or an incident that he wanted to know something about, because they kept everything down. Mm-hmm. So I was in a very good position, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to provide him sometimes with information. Because, you know, the correspondence from Time Inc. reporters all over the world,
right.
came in and were put into those files. Mm-hmm. You know, so I had access to tremendous information. And sometimes, you know, I passed stuff on to him, while I was there.
So when did you first start working for Ebony Magazine?
Well, when I left the country in July 1965, mm-hmm. came back in September.
And where did you go?
I went to go to Cairo.
Okay.
I guess because Brother Malcolm had been there to the OAU meeting in the summer of 1964. Mm-hmm. So I took a freighter to Casablanca in Morocco. And then I was supposed to get another freighter on to Cairo. And I think I missed it. And so it was going to be 2 or 3 weeks for another one left. So I just said, I'm not going to sit around that long. So I then came into Europe and spent some time in Paris. I met a brother who was a member of the OAAU in Paris. We had an OAAU in Paris.
Mm-hmm. They blocked Malcolm from...
Yeah, when they banned him from coming to France.
Right.
And he gave me the information on that. And I was able to provide him with information about the assassination and everything. And after that, in December of 1965, I took a job with Johnson Publishing Company, you know, who publishes Ebony and Jet magazines. Mm-hmm. I took a job in the mailroom. Mm-hmm. And I took it because I figured I just wanted to get in there, I could eventually work my way, you know, up. Mm-hmm. And it took about a year and a half, but it finally happened. And I came into the staff of Ebony in late 1967. Mm-hmm. And I was on Ebony staff until 1976.
And so you shared with me not too long ago a story about Aretha Franklin. And do you mind sharing that story?
Yeah, when she passed, died recently, I wrote a column called My Most Precious Memory of Aretha. And what had happened was that I always worked out of Ebony's New York office. And they had an Ebony editor, a Jet editor, two photographers, and an administrative assistant, a receptionist. And so there used to be a column in Jet called New York Beat, which is kind of a little gossip column, you know, two or three line items, different things. If the Jet editor was away on assignment or out on vacation, for any reason, was not in the office when that column was due, they would ask me to write the column. So it just so happened this particular time, he was away on assignment, and Aretha was performing at Radio City Music Hall, which is a major performing outlet in New York City. And I covered her performance. I went to it. And she had just lost weight. She had lost a lot of weight. So to kind of show off her new size, she did a show that was almost like a Diana Ross type show, you know, dragging the fur coat across the stage and, you know, just doing all of that, you know, between songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, she still sang.
Right.
Still, you know, did her singing. But she was doing all that little Diana Ross type. I call it the Diana Ross type stuff. So when I wrote the New York Beat column for that week, I said that I said I wish that Aretha would understand that, you know, she don't have to do all of that. All we want to do when we go see her is to hear her glorious voice. Mm-hmm. Something like that. So about 6 months later, she was back in the New York area. And Barbara Harris, who was a PR person with Atlantic Records, which was Aretha's record company, she called me and said, "Peter, I just got a call from Aretha. And she told me to make sure that you're at this concert."
Uh-oh.
"And to bring you back to her dressing room."
Uh-oh.
"When the concert is over." So I said to myself, "Oh man, she's getting ready to get on my case about what I wrote, you know, in Jet." And so at that particular show, she just sat at the piano or stood at the mic and just sang. It was none of that, you know, that stuff she had done in Radio City Music Hall. So when the concert was over, Barbara came and got me and took me backstage. And, you know, I'm nervous.
Were you scared?
I'm nervous, man. I am nervous. Because I figure I'm getting ready to get a really good chewing out. So when I walked into her dressing room, I mean, she was waiting on us. It looked like she was waiting on us.
Sitting with her leg crossed, patting her foot.
Well, she wasn't patting her foot, but she had her legs crossed. And so we walked in. I said, good evening, Miss Franklin. And she said, good evening. And then she said, what did you think of this concert? I said, that's what I'm talking about. I said, you were incredible. And she said, thank you. And then we talked for about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling her how much I loved her music, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked for about 5 or 6 minutes. And then Barbara took me away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote that. I wrote a column that was my most precious Aretha Franklin moment.
Wow. So she must have really thought something of that to invite you, to want you to come and see her show and to ask your opinion of what you thought about this show.
Yeah, she really, I mean, I'm like saying to myself, because, you know, that the New York Beat column was like, they were like a series of like 4 or 5 line items.
Mm-hmm.
It was not like a straight through column. You know, you wrote like maybe 3 or 4 lines about this subject, 3 or 4 lines. It was like a gossip column. That's really what it was. And but everybody read it. I mean, it was probably one of the most read sections in Jet Magazine was that New York Beat column, man. And so obviously she read it.
Mm-hmm.
And she told Barbara to bring me backstage. And I just, after I got over, I said, you know, that's a little bit flattering that she would be so disturbed about something that I had written, that she would do that. But she actually did it.
Were there any other, like, celebrities that stood out to you from your career working at Ebony?
Yeah, I mean, I did a big cover story on Gladys Knight when she got married. I wrote articles on Lionel Richie. I did an article on, on Jennifer Holliday. I did a cover story for Ebony on Dreamgirls, the play.
Mm-hmm.
I did articles on for Jet on Adam Clayton Powell.
Did you have did you meet him?
Yes.
What was he like?
he was. I had never heard a quote unquote preacher who cussed like he did, man.
Really?
I remember I interviewed him after when some of the people who had supported him for a long time, and they kind of turned on him and ran against him,
mm-hmm.
and in the Democratic primary, and he lost. So I had to go for again. I was doing this for Jet.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up and interviewed him the next day, man. And boy, I never heard such cussing in my life. In Abyssinian Baptist Church. Now, not in the sanctuary, but in his office in the church. He was really angry, man. He called them every kind of you know what that he could think of.
Did you take notes? And
I wrote the article. But I had to clean it up. I had to clean it up.
Did you have a recorder going while?
No, I was taking notes by hand.
Oh, darn.
I had to clean it up when I wrote it. But if I had been to do what he was saying, it would never have gotten to Jet. Jeff would have been able to publish it, man. He was like, but he was really angry, man. I've been thinking about doing maybe a small book called Vignettes. And people that I like, the Aretha Franklin story and Adam Powell story and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's story and the Al Green story, you know, things that did not get into the article, mm-hmm. maybe about a page, page and a half.
Was it that didn't get into the article about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
Well, it wasn't anything. It was just that he came down to I was living in Richmond then, and he came down to Petersburg, Virginia. He was doing a documentary on a brother named Vernon Johns. See, most people don't know Reverend Johns. Vernon Johns was the minister of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, before Dr. King came to that church. And the reason he was let go, because he was so radical, they considered him too radical. So they put him out, and Dr. King came in to replace him. Well, and he was a leader down there in Petersburg, Virginia area, you know, in the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And Kareem was doing a documentary on him. So this paper in Virginia, because, you know, I was doing freelance type thing, called me and asked me to do an article on Kareem and this thing. So I went down, and that was when I was really could see, man, that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, this brother was not no silly,
just your average athlete,
man. This brother was serious, and you know. But and I remember when I was interviewing him, I had a tape recorder, and I was standing, and I would held my arm as high as I could go to put the tape recorder in front of him. And even with then, I couldn't do it.
Right.
I said, Kareem,
he's over like 7 feet. Right?
I said, Kareem, you got to sit down. You got to sit down. I cannot interview you standing up. So I said, you got to sit down. So he laughed, and then he sat down, and we continued the interview.
Now, what made him think that somebody was going to stand up and hold their arm up for an extended amount of time, and he's over 7 feet tall?
Well, I'm 5 feet. I'm 5'10". And with my arm stayed up, you know, they added another few inches. But that was my fault. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm standing up there holding this tape recorder.
Right.
And that thing was nowhere near his mouth. So I said, man, Kareem, you got to sit down. So he sat down, and then I interviewed him. Mm-hmm. But that's when I found out what a serious person that he was. Because Vernon John's daughter was a brilliant young lady. When she was 15 years old, she led a school walkout in Petersburg. She wanted the black high school to be given the same types of, you know, equipment and books and things that the white high school got. So she led this movement to get that done. And her name was Barbara Johns. Mm. She was 15 years old. Mm. And they were so slick. They arranged for they told the principal that some students were having trouble in downtown, so he would be gone, and they would not be holding him responsible. Mm-hmm. So they had a big rally in the auditorium at the high school. Mm-hmm. And that became a part of Brown versus Board. Mm-hmm. But the thing about it that always interests me, and I find fascinating and a little bit offsetting, is that the NAACP told them that because she was fighting for her school. She was, integration was not even nowhere near where she was. She couldn't care less about integration. She wanted her school to be given the same, you know, supplies and books and things that the white school got. Because what they would do in those days, when the white school books got old and things like that, they would then give them to the black, and by the white folks, new material. Mm-hmm. And then give them the ones that the white. So she was leading the campaign against that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And the NAACP people, I found out later, told her that she had to make her struggle one for integration, mm-hmm. rather than and so they changed it, became that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you also got involved in the theater world. So how did that come about?
Well, being in Ebony's New York office, I was in that period between 19, let's say 65 and 1985, that 20-year period, maybe 1960 to 1985. I mean, black theater people were doing incredible work. Black theater people, black dance people, black music people. I mean, they were doing incredible work. And of course, being in Ebony's New York office, I almost automatically, you know, was covering this. Mm-hmm. I was having a hard time getting Ebony to do articles on it, you know, because, you know, they say, oh, that's just in New York. You know, it's not all over the country. Mm-hmm. But I say, well, you know, you can make it national by making people aware of the incredible work that these theater people are doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's when I met people like Denzel and those.
What was that like?
Anna Maria Horsford.
Now, let's go back to Denzel.
He did a play. I don't know whether it was his first play, mm-hmm. but he did a play. This brother had written two one-act plays. One was called The Chickens Come Home to Roost, and Denzel played Brother Malcolm. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting in that theater that night, man, and I'm saying to myself, is this guy an actor, or is that really Malcolm X on stage? Mm. That's how brilliant he was.
And so in your memoir, you kind of talked about him
playing Malcolm. Yeah, that's how brilliant he was.
Later on.
Yeah. And then, you know, Debbie Allen, and I met a lot of those people who, like Roxy Roker, Bobby Hooks, a lot of those people who went on to, you know, to be in movies and things. They were in the working with in those black theater companies during that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, those black theater companies were The River Niger by Joseph
James
Walker.
Earl Jones? Was he in that?
Huh?
James Earl Jones? Did
he? I think he was in the movie version.
Okay.
And then Charlie Fuller did this incredible play, The Brownsville Raid. And Richard Wesley did incredible plays. I mean, Roger Furman was the greatest theater person I ever met. He could do anything in theater. You know, he ran a theater company in Harlem. Ernie McClintock, Hazel Bryant. I mean, they were doing shoestring budgets, man. But they were doing absolutely incredible work. And as I say, because I'm in Ebony's, I finally got Ebony to understand the importance of this. So I did several articles on black theater. Mm-hmm. When Ebony did that special issue called The Black Revolution, you know, every August they would do a special issue. And I did the one on the revolution in black theater. Mm-hmm. And then I did a long piece on black women, you know, in theater, not as actresses, but as directors, you know, and that kind of thing. Ebony had never done those kind of articles before. Mm-hmm. And I was doing almost all Ebony's theater art. That's how I got into it. Mainly because I'm in the New York office and that's where all of this is going on.
Is that how you met Alvin Ailey?
Yes, I met Alvin directly because of being with Ebony, and they assigned me to do in 1968 when black students began to organize on white college campuses. Black students up at Dartmouth College, they were having the first black weekend. I think it's called the Black Weekend, and. One of the things they did for that weekend, they had invited the Ailey Company up to perform. And I went up and I saw the Ailey Company perform for the first time. And of course, when they did Revelations, I said, you know, growing up in the South, and I said, man, you ain't supposed to be dancing to the kind of music, man. This place is going to get struck by lightning or something. You know, because, you know, it's all the music in Revelations is gospel, you know, and spirituals. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, you're not supposed to be dancing. But, and then after that, I began to go to Alvin's performances, and when the company celebrated its 25th anniversary, I did a big article at Ebony around that 25th anniversary, and as the associate director of the Black Theater Alliance, Alvin's company was a member of the Alliance. It was an organization of black theater and dance companies. But I tell people all the time, that period between 1960 and 1985, black folks in theater, dance, and music were doing some absolutely incredible things. That, to me, topped what they call the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. What they were doing, to me, topped the Harlem Renaissance.
Why do you say that?
Because they were able to reach more people. They had more support, although they didn't get nearly the support they deserved. But and there was a little bit more. They had more support and more. And by Ebony covering them, you know, giving them, you know, attention, so they had a kind of an advantage. But in terms of creation, of works, they match anything that came out of the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think of some of the plays and the, you know, dances that I saw, Elio Palmieri doing, and John, you know, John, what was John's name? God, the brother was an incredible dancer. Now I can't think of his last name. But I was there doing that. I was there during that time era when those black theater and dance and companies and music, they were doing some incredible work between 60 and 85. That was an incredible stretch of black theater and dance and music. And I covered it because I was in, you know, Ebony's New York office.
So when did you, going forward, you eventually started teaching in colleges and universities. So when did that happen?
That happened first in 1980, I think it was 87. But a friend of mine and a brilliant journalist and writer named Ord Coons. Ord was teaching a summer program for journalism students, a 10 weeks long program at Hunter College. And that year he was not able to do it. So he asked Hunter to let me do it. And I did it. I did it for 3 years. Mm-hmm. They would bring in journalism students, about 25 journalism students from all over the country, black journalism students. And I taught them. Mm-hmm. And then Hunter then hired me to teach journalism students, you know, in the semesters. So I did that for a couple of years until I moved out of New York. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. That's how I got into teaching.
And so now I know you still write for the Trice at the Wire Service.
Uh-huh.
So what is your work focused on today? Like some of the columns that you write about?
Well,
today?
The column that I just turned into her yesterday is called Young Black Trumpets Swoon and Dine in Trump's White House. Mm. And I had read an article that they'd had a young black leadership summit. Mm-hmm. And these young black millennials came to this thing and had lunch with President Trump in the White House. And then while they were having the lunch, I heard they were chanting, build that wall.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I wrote a column on it, in which I called it, I call Trump supporters Trumpets. Trumpetts. So I say young black trumpets swoon and dine in the White House.
Okay.
And I've got a column coming up I'm working on immigration, where I am showing that in 1916, this WASP named Madison Grant wrote a book called The Passing of a Great Race. And he was very upset that the United States was allowing all these people coming into this country from Italy and Poland and those kind of places. In fact, he divided Europeans into three race, white people into three races, the Nordics, the Alpines, and the Mediterraneans. He had no use for the Mediterraneans, especially the Italians, because he said they had too much contact with Africa. Mm. And he was very upset that they were allowing them to come into the country. And then I quoted him extensively. And then I say, the descendants of these people are now, you know, saying the same things about the Latinos that Madison Grant was saying about them. Mm. You know, and so I was, you know, I kind of used that as a takeoff on this whole immigration thing. I'll be very frank with you. I think that knowing President Trump and his marketing skills, I would be willing to bet that this so-called caravan was started by somebody who supports Trump. Because it has given him 2 weeks of time. Now, why all of a sudden, 2 weeks before the election, you got this caravan, quote unquote, coming, and for 2 weeks is all he's been talking about. Mm. And this is, for his people, this is the biggest issue. Mm. I swear I believe that somebody in Honduras or wherever that was, is somebody who supported Trump. Mm. And he's had 2 weeks of conversation about this caravan invasion coming and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was just too much of a coincidence that this would come up 2 weeks before the midterm elections.
Mm. Well,
I don't believe in coincidences like that, especially with a man who has the who has the marketing awareness and skills of President Trump. Mm. This is giving him 2 weeks to talk about that, and it stays in the news.
Mm. Let me sip my coffee. Mm. Mm. Okay, so we're running low on time.
Uh-huh.
And I like to do this thing that I call Fast Five, where I ask my guests 5 questions, and you give me the first answer that pops into your head.
Mm-hmm.
Who was your favorite person to interview?
I would say Brother Malcolm. Mm. I'd be very frankly, I really would say that.
What do you wish you knew more about?
I wish I knew more about, much more about Africa and what's going on the continent. I know quite a bit, but I still don't think that I know enough. I really would like to know more about what's happening on the African continent.
Hmm. What book has impacted you the most?
Well, I've been several books that have impacted me, but one that impacted me recently was this book, Ebony and Ivy, which is a book about where this brother, who's a professor at MIT, shows that all the major colleges in this country, the Ivy League schools and University of Virginia and Georgetown, were all built on money made by the enslavement of African people. Mm. It's called Ebony and Ivy. It's something.
What is something you will never do again?
I will never again. Now that's hard. boy. I don't know. I haven't had anything in my life, you know, that was so terrible.
That you would never do.
I guess I've been pretty lucky. I haven't anything. I think I've got one thing I'd do. I would never do.
Yeah.
One thing I would never do is to not spend enough time asking questions of my grandparents.
Mm.
I wish I had done that. Mm. I mean, I picked up a lot of stuff from them, but I never really sat down with them, you know, and asked questions. I just kind of picked up, you know.
And what do you want to be remembered as?
What?
What do you want to be remembered as?
A serious black man who truly believes that the only way that we're going to ever maximize our position in this world is a close relationship between black people in North America and black people on the African continent. Mm-hmm. We have no choice. If we don't get together and work more closely with each other, then we will be condemning our great-grandchildren to being at the bottom of the international arena.
Mm. And so you have a upcoming panel that you'll be on this coming Thursday at the University of the District of Columbia. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I've been asked to be on a panel on stereotyping in the American press, on how the American press stereotypes black people. This is a subject of which I am very, very, I've done a lot of reading about and research on. I think one of the things that we have not done as a group of people is pay nearly enough attention to attacks on the mind.
Which is something
Brother Malcolm did that. And the only other person I know who did that, who had a national platform other than him, was Dr. C. Dolores Tucker when she went after gangster rap music. Mm-hmm. But today you don't hear a single person in a leadership position with a national outlet talking about this. And our problem in this country today is not physical attacks. It's attacks on the mind. And in movies and televisions and textbooks and all that kind of stuff, man. And And it, we got to deal with that. We got to deal with that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bailey, for joining me again. Again, this was an insightful conversation.
Thank you.
So this has been an episode of DCPL's All Things Local on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Please visit us at dclibrary.org to learn more about the library's resources and services. Talk to us online at DCPL on Twitter and at DC Public Library on Instagram. Listen and download this show wherever you listen to your podcasts by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.